Good evening and welcome, my friends. Your presence is our great blessing for all of us as we come together in our shared intention for the fullness of the human possibility. So each of us come from near and far, bearing our gifts, our longings of the heart, still in the beginning days of this year of holy remembering, and knowing that there is a light among us. There is choice. There are laws of the universes, and there are possibilities for us. They arise from an embodied life that is full and joyful. And so may it be for us. So we have lit the Christ candle as a symbol of this hope and vision of the light. And in so doing, we call upon the conscious circle of humanity to gather with us and inform us. So we begin in the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. So tonight we will again begin with a word about Jean de Salzman, who was a learned and adept student and being. And it is said that Mr. Gurdjieff had very high regard for her and chose her to be the focal point of the continuation of his work. And we will be engaging with her teachings on both the personal and psychological level and the cosmic level all of this year. She was born, as I mentioned last week, on January 26, 1889, and she died on May 24, 1990. A long and very rich life. It is said that Mr. Gurdjieff had asked her to live to be 100, and she actually lived to be 101. So isn't it wonderful that one goes a little further than the wishes of their teacher. May it be so for us as well. So the quotation is really about her, and it is from the director, Peter Brook, who was the director of the film of Gurdjieff's Meetings with Remarkable Men. And he speaks of her in this way. And all of this was printed in the Gurdjieff International Review in 1998. I would like to be able to draw a portrait with words of this remarkable person, but I know how inadequate this would be. In my work with actors, I have learned that impersonation only succeeds if it can capture the rigid areas in which a personality is imprisoned. Someone whose life flows freely has none of these rigidities on which imitations or even descriptions can comfortably hang. Madame de Salzman had achieved this freedom through a life devoted to the service of that unknown source of finer energy that can only become manifest when the human organism is completely open, open in body, feeling, and thought. When this connection is reached, the individuality does not vanish. Rather, it is illuminated in every aspect and can play its true role, which is to bend and adapt to every changing need. Madame de Salzman would always rise graciously to welcome a visitor. She would sit upright, still, and contained, and would respond with laughter or seriousness, finding precisely the words and the idiom that corresponded to the age and understanding of the listener. Her speaking was not for herself. She was never carried away by her own memories or her own ideas. Rather, out of an awareness of what was needed, out of listening to the other person's state. She would speak directly to the person so as to evoke a meaning or encourage an action to arise. She was always present, as close to the need as demanded. Yet in this closeness, she was never to be grasped. No one could hold her, and she held on to no one. There are many reasons for describing a human being as remarkable. For Gurdjieff, the essential quality of a remarkable man or woman was the capacity to watch equally over the lamb and the wolf in his or her care, to cherish the tenderness of the one and the ferocity of the other, to give to each its place. It is only possible if there is a special kind of presence that reconciles, unites, and holds them both in balance. What an extraordinary statement to say about someone. And thus we get a glimpse of the value of the work, our own work, and the aim of a three-centered being. May it be so for each of us. So just a word tonight about the notion of sacred space. And one might take a look at the space in which we are participating in the Thursday classes and perhaps consider creating a, shall we say, consecrated space for these evenings. And what does that mean? It means that perhaps the space is uncluttered, simple, perhaps incorporating a touch of beauty, perhaps lighting a candle. But most importantly, recognizing that our space is a place of intentionality, a vessel, you might say, dedicated to do our work. So that's something to ponder as to what that might look like for each of us as we begin. So having said all of that, let's begin our own centering process and bring ourselves to the here and now. For how we come matters. How we participate matters, for that is what we are emanating into the group. So we place ourselves with intention and imminent trust and receptivity to the influences which are coming to us from the circle of conscious humanity and from one another. And we prepare to receive these influences this evening, taking them in high valuation, with back upright, mind quiet, in directed attention, body relaxed, noticing perhaps, and then releasing all tension, constriction, resistance. We breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything, everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, all affirming, all denying, and we hold it as offering reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that all be transubstantiated in our being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I open to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. So now we enter into the time of Lectio Divina, and we will share a reading three times with a pause in between each reading to absorb it and take it in and see what it is offering us. Wisdom has built her house. She has set up her seven columns. She has dressed her meat, mixed her wine. Yes, she spread her table. She has sent out her maidens. She calls from the heights out over the city. Let whoever is simple turn in here. To the one who lacks understanding, I say, come eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake foolishness that you may live. Advance in the way of understanding. Begin with a yearning of the heart. Be receptive to higher influences. And at no point work for results. For we do not know what the ultimate is. Can we begin to know what transformation in and as Christ is? No. Do your work, and at every step you will be guided to the next right thing. Trust that you will be given glimpses of truth. The important thing is to have a vessel that is sealed and can receive and preserve the truth. This vessel is the heart, which is the ark in ourselves. This is the place of possibility of new birth. As above, so below. Wisdom has built her house. She has set up her seven columns. She has dressed her meat, mixed her wine. Yes, she spread her table. She has sent out her maidens. She calls from the heights out over the city. Let whoever is simple turn in here. To the one who lacks understanding, I say, come, eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake foolishness that you may live. Advance in the way of understanding. Begin with a yearning of the heart. Be receptive to higher influences, and at no point work for results. For we do not know what the ultimate is. Can we begin to know what transformation in and as Christ is? No. Do your work, and at every step you will be guided to the next right thing. Trust that you will be given glimpses of truth. The important thing is to have a vessel that is sealed and can receive and preserve the truth. This vessel is the heart, which is the ark in ourselves. This is the place of possibility of new birth. As above, so below. Wisdom has built her house. She has set up her seven columns. She has dressed her meat, mixed her wine. Yes, she spread her table. She has sent out her maidens. She calls from the heights out over the city. Let whoever is simple turn in here. To the one who lacks understanding, I say, come, eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake foolishness that you may live. Advance in the way of understanding. Begin with a yearning of the heart. Be receptive to higher influences, and at no point work for results. For we do not know what the ultimate is. Can we begin to know what transformation in as Christ is? No. Do your work, and at every step, you will be guided to the next right thing. Trust that you will be given glimpses of truth. The important thing is to have a vessel that is sealed and can receive and preserve the truth. This vessel is the heart, which is the ark in ourselves. This is the place of possibility of new birth. As above, so below. And so it is. So now you are invited to share with us what you received from this passage. So good evening and welcome, Jackie.
Good evening. How are you, Marianne?
Good.
I hear the law of seven in this passage. And we are beginning a new, hopefully passive dough as we begin this year. And I ponder, can I formulate a future memory of this entire octave of this year? What are the meats that I am to prepare, which I hopefully will be preparing for my consumption and maybe for others as well. And it's exciting because I have experienced other octaves and I recognize that I need to, in each moment, make as much effort as I am capable of. And that is what the entire octave is made up of. And that is my wish. And because I recognize the importance of the entire community participating in that for my work, I'm delighted. So thank you for this invitation and reminder that we have a role, but we're not the only ones that have a role in this octave.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Jackie. I join you in that wish. I join you. Cami, good evening.
Good evening, Marianne and everyone. I'm not often taken as deeply by the imagery, the picture. I'm a word person and I love the words, but tonight's picture just really captivated me, and the idea of wisdom laying out her columns and the use of words that describe a banquet. And to me, when I look at that picture, I see the Eucharist above each of those pillars. And coming from a Catholic formation, the Eucharist was so important to me. And one of the challenges that I found in my Catholic formation was preserving, there was such a great reverence for the Eucharist, but then a protecting of the Eucharist, like we wouldn't share. No, not everyone was welcome to the table. And that never felt good to me. And this image and this reading just celebrated for me the wisdom that the Christ essence is put out into the world in so many beautiful ways. And that by my training of reverence and seeking and consuming of the Christ through the Eucharist over those years, it was not to protect it and hoard it. It was to see it in the world in so many ways. So I found myself smiling a great deal, looking at the image and taking in these words and inspiration that with the Church of Conscious Harmony, I am on a path of those higher influences that are resonating so well with me. Mm.
Thank you, Cami, so much for that and the connection with the Eucharist. I can see it now, thanks to your pointing it out. So I've just, for the moment, I'm going to call on Frida first, because it's been a while since we've heard from you. Welcome.
So what I saw in the image, and this could be because of the homework about constellations, but in the I saw a stylized constellations. And again, it might be the influence of the homework, but I did like that. It was very organized, but still my eyes were wanting to name them. And it may have a different, maybe that is some kind of pattern in there. It'll be interesting to see the instructor, what he talks about. The end. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Frida. So Rodney, welcome. You're muted at the, Rodney. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, everybody. So I heard we do not know what the ultimate is. And so often, the work tells us about where are we at in our psychological country. And I realized that, I can see where I am in my psychological country, but I can also think, well, maybe this country is located on a planet, and maybe this planet is located in a solar system, in the universe. And in the infinite possibilities up to God Almighty. I don't really know, you know, what, where it is that I need to be or I want to be or I think I should be. And if I can just let go of that and just live in this place of I don't know, it's such a relief, such a putting down of a burden. It opens me up to all possibilities, infinite possibilities, actually, and allows me to actually let God just take me to where he knows where I need to go. Yes. And so, you know, that's my mantra these days is, I don't know.
Yes, take me to the possibility. Yes. Thank you, Rodney. Melba.
Thank you, Mary. And hi, everyone. What stood out to me was the comment of seek the way of understanding. And the minute you read that, all I could think of was, I did. And I think I found it with the Conscious Harmony Church. And what I was, what I noticed was that there was only six pillars. And when you got to that part about your heart, I realized that the perspective meant so that you include as a center of wisdom, whether we know it or not, our heart has that internal wisdom. And so that's what the seventh pillar was for me.
It's beautiful, Melba. Thank you so much for that. Thank you. And so we'll close this section with Hattie. Good evening.
Good evening. When I heard you read the Lectio Divina, I just heard hospitality. I heard from the feminine god, who she spread out her table, come eat of my food and drink of the wine I have mixed for you. I felt the openness of God's table. And the feminine god invites us all to take part in the faith that she offers to us and in the work. And she feeds my soul and she fulfills my thirst for love and mercy and for forgiveness. And I feel so welcome. I feel so welcome, especially with this reading. And I'm inspired to continue it and continue receiving the hospitality and grow with it and share it with others. Mm. Thank you.
Oh, that's beautiful, Hattie. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And for everyone, those sharings. I feel like my own heart has been sealed as a vessel just by your sharings and your presence. So thank you, everyone. So now it is my joy to introduce Peter for this next phase of our evening. And as he gathers our attention to what we heard last week about the Trinity of Forces and the Trinity of Being and how we engage that teaching and also the homework. Thank you, Peter. Welcome.
Thank you, Marianne, and thank you, everyone, for your presence. Good to be together. How enriching to hear those sharings of how people hear and see the image and what's been prepared. Thank you, everyone. Robin will be teaching tonight, but it is our custom every Thursday evening to spend a good amount of time sharing our experience of our homework. And because we're just beginning this year, we haven't really gotten too deep into the homework and the application of the work ideas. Also doesn't help that we're talking about really big ideas about the cosmology. It's hard to find a way to apply that to our day-to-day lives, but we have found some ways and we've made some suggestions on how we could do that. One of the hopes for our time of homework sharing is that you as an individual have actually applied the work ideas throughout the week going forward, and that you really interact with the email and the questions and the homework at the end of the email. And for many of us, we're working through some of this homework or some of the ideas of the email in our journey groups. And so we all get a way of interacting with other people's work in the journey group. And some of us are working with a journey partner, a work partner. And so you have these three things coming together all at once. And certainly it's a very rich way of doing work and pondering these things together and to sharing together. One other comment about the homework is that we tend to get the same people reporting on the homework, which is fine and good in as much as their work is fruitful and good and real, and it is. But there are many more of us who aren't sharing. And so the model here of Zoom makes it a little harder to feel comfortable sharing. But I do encourage people who haven't shared to share, to try it and to explore applying the work ideas to your life and to share at least some point this year. So with that said, I want to just kind of read a portion of last week's homework. Robin's teaching was so significant and big, it's hard to grasp. And the homework quoted Mr. Nickel, and I'll just read this from the email. He writes, "The three forces cannot be studied theoretically, although I think we try at some level to understand them more." But Mr. Nickel goes on to say, "The only practical way of studying three forces in ourselves, the only practical way of studying three forces in ourselves is by doing something. And it's by observing what we're doing and seeing and noticing where the three forces are." He writes, "By this is meant imitating or personifying in ourselves one of the three forces in relation to some other force, acting in ourselves or in external events." And so the homework invitation was this: pick a habit, a disposition of your personality, of yourself, of your facial expression, whatever it might be, a habit, a disposition, an encounter, an event, and note the first force and the second force. Can you get a glimpse of what the third force might be? And so that was an invitation to do our work by applying these big ideas in a very personal way. So I'm wondering who would like to begin with, be the courageous one to begin our time of sharing and reporting on the homework. And we'll turn to Todd Buchanan. Thank you, Todd.
All right, well, thanks for the invitation. For me this week, I applied the homework to the events that have been going on in my life. And what that's about is a lot of chores and tasks around preparing my house to sell it. And specifically in the last week, clean up after the big ice storm. And the thing I can report about this is that this one has an overly exuberant personality. And when I set off into a task, I am wildly over optimistic about how fast I'm going to get it done and what that's going to look like. And I've been able to observe that there's a fair amount of pride and vanity in all of that. After the ice storm, I went out in my yard, and one of my first thoughts that I self-observed was, well, I'm going to be the first one on the street to get it all cleaned up. I'm just going to get out there and knock it out, man. Give me 2 or 3 days and I'll have it done. And here it is a week later, and I'm not even close to having it done. And this has been just a very recurring theme for me in the last several months of being in imagination. And what that leads to is that when the second force of not getting the task done as quickly and efficiently as I have in my mind, I feel sad, I feel angry, I feel frustrated. I get depressed. I feel despondent, like I'm never going to get it done. And what I find is it's a huge drain of energy for me. It just sucks the life out of me when I come up against second force. And so I'm coming to realize very slowly that this is a real thing for this one's personality. Is I like the energy to be all ginned up. I want to ramp up the energy. And when that doesn't turn into reality, it leads me to this crash. And so one of the things I've self-observed and noticed is that when I'm doing these tasks and I'm running into second force, it's my mental fatigue that slows me down. It's not my physical fatigue. I can still do what I need to do, but mentally I feel tired and bored and weighed down and like I'm not getting it done. And it's, you know, so I just see this real loss of force in this whole process. And so the question about where's third force in all of that and where does it come in? And Nickel says, well, it's kind of hard to see third force. And I would agree with that. And all I can really report on that part of it is, for me, it has to do with patience. And because it's going to get done. The task will get done, but it just is going to take a lot longer than I thought it was. And so if I can just simmer down a little bit, calm down, and, you know, my mantra has been slow and steady wins the race, because I tend to just jump in and go full force and then crash against the wall. So this is a real thing for my personality, and it's been a kind of a vivid lesson in the last few months. Thanks.
Oh, gosh. Thank you, Todd, for what an articulate report. And you know, you've schooled us all on not only some of the insights about the three forces in your life practically, but also how to report. You're using work language. You're using the ideas. You're applying the work ideas within this container of your life. It's a beautiful expression. Thank you, brother. And yeah, I'm very curious. Something what you said just triggered a curiosity for me about what happens to us emotionally when we don't have a third force, or the third force is something destructive or negative or corrosive, and what that might do to us emotionally. So I'm just going to ponder that. Thank you very much for sharing, Todd. We'll go to Lisa Morgan next, please, and then Jackie.
Hi, Peter. Thank you. And yeah, I appreciate Todd sharing for modeling. My work this week is with the three forces. It's not new. I'm in Ohio for the month with my aging parent, which is an event. It's an event that I'm sure millions of people experience. And I made a conscious aim before I flew out to Ohio to not be mechanical in my reaction to my mother. And so when I apply it to the three forces, it feels a bit like mother and I are playing ping pong, and she's first force, I'm second force, then I'm first force, she's second force. And it has been great effort for me to almost try to treat her as a stranger, which sounds odd, versus my mother, because I have a reaction to my mother. If I look at her as a woman, as an individual, as not my mother experiencing aging and progressing into dementia and potentially Alzheimer's, I think that is third force, in that I can externally consider her. It makes me want to cry because it breaks my heart when I put her in that context. But I think that's a neutralizing force, calling upon the work and God to, you know, help us get out of the ping pong game and help me to rise above that and just be a gentle guide for her versus trying to push her and getting her to do things that she can't do anymore. And that's, you know, that's what I have to realize. So it's been pretty fruitful this week, and God only knows I have three more weeks here. So continued effort will be made.
Well, we join with you in that future memory of 3 weeks from now. So much insight and wisdom and work has come through this dynamic. You know, we don't have a problem when we do the little exercise and say, this thought or this thing is not I. It's okay when we not identify like that internally. But what you're suggesting to me sounds like kind of a radical non-identification, stripping your mother of even her own identity to you. This woman is not my mother. This woman is just here. This is a woman struggling. This is a woman forgetting. It's a radical non-identification, which is, I hear you, it's a type of third force that removes you from the conflict. Wow. Thank you. Jackie, please. Hey, Jackie, we're having a hard time hearing you. Maybe just come speak a little closer to the microphone. Sorry.
A neighbor has a very negative and forceful way of expressing your thoughts. And I remember that you can't very identify that.
Jackie, I'm so sorry. We can't hear you at all right now. I'm sorry. This has happened before. I'm so sorry. We just value your wisdom. Thank you. Yeah, that's a bummer. I'm going to go to Rachel next. Rachel Smith, please. And then Beth.
Hi, good evening, everyone. So yes, the work came to meet me without me really realizing it in the moment. But I had I guess you would, call it a conscious shock of, so I, my partner's kind of expressing himself in a way that in my mind felt not okay. And just, you know, his frustration. And so when it came time to talk about that with him and feeling totally right and my perspective, and wanting, you know, I'm not really sure what first and second and third is exactly here. I just know that it, there was something working here, and that it came time to talk about it. And I was shown an eye within myself that needs things to be a certain way. And I need this to be this way and this to be that way. And my own frustration, which was very humbling, because I just am seeing the reading tonight, the surrendering, I don't think that word was used in the reading tonight, but just the word surrender is coming to me. And you know, it's a very different conversation to have in terms of relationship with my husband. But when I was given that opportunity to see my own frustration of how things need to be, and very humbling. I don't know if I worded that well, but
well, I think you did. And can I, if I can just ask a clarifying question?
Yeah.
Are you saying that what you saw about yourself, your preferences or demands or whatever, was the second force?
Let me think. My first force was my desire of wanting things to be different. I think wanting things to be different, wanting some kind of change, because I certainly wanted that. But when it came down to the conversation and it being revealed to me that my need for things to be changed within my partner, like what a pattern that is within me, like with my children and my life, like things need to go in this way, and how debilitating that is.
Okay, so that makes sense. That's a powerful first force, so it's going to draw naturally a second force, which you may not like, or he may not like, or your kids may not like. It right. sounds pretty common.
Yes. Yeah, very, very humbling. And mm-hmm. and really sitting with that and the emotions that come with that, which is despair, like I need things to be a certain way, and understanding when I felt that way before when I was younger, and all of that, and how that no longer serves me today to need things to be a certain way. I want it to be God's way and the surrendering.
Yeah, so it sounds like the third force came as this kind of insight or awareness of this notion of surrendering. That's how I'm hearing it anyway.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks
for sharing. Yeah, I think you speak for a lot of us, so thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll go to Beth. And I saw Jack and Jackie's hand up, but I don't see it anymore, so then we'll go to Sabrina.
Hi, everybody. My experience this week with the three forces was that I was elected in my family to try to find a place to have a family reunion on the eclipse, during the eclipse in 2024. And I spent days researching and finding places already booked, and all of the family was texting me and going, whatever you find, it's great. Thank you for doing this research. And I just happened to find a place that just that day had opened their calendar for 2024. So I went, wow, this is great. This is going to, this is meant to be. And so I put everything together and sent the emails and texts to the family, and my error was not calculating second force. I had a really big first force here, really big. I really wanted this to happen, and so when I sent this out to the family, various members of the family were going, well, wait a minute, what about this, and why don't we do that, and this is too much money, and just huge second force. And so my reaction was, good God, you guys. I mean, I didn't verbalize this. Let's get on board. Let's do this. It's going to go away. It's not going to stay here forever. In fact, the place was totally booked within 3 days. And so I had enough presence of mind and presence of God to just take a break, to take a walk, to do a sit. And while all these emails and texts were going back and forth, and what I saw was myself in other situations when I was that second force, when I was the yes, but why don't we do this? And so the third force was external considering, that seeing myself in the past, in that position, and recognizing that they had valid points. This wasn't the only way to do this, and we could change things around a little bit and meet everybody's objections, and we were able to do that. So anyway, that's my story of the three forces this week.
Thank you, Beth. Yeah, I mean, it's a story about your journey working with your family, which is probably a long, long journey, a long lifetime together. And that's so useful because you do get these segments or these past memories with the same people that you can draw upon as a kind of third force. And I love that came to you. You saw at one point you had done something similar that in the way that they were reacting. So that is a beautiful example of third force, where you see something in their behavior that you discover in yourself, and it kind of neutralizes it. Well, blessings on your journey. We'll go to Sabrina, and then we'll conclude Well, then we'll go to Jack and Jack. And
all right. Hi, everybody. This is my first time to share in this forum. I'm new to the work. I am familiar with observer role, like observing false selves. I had an event yesterday, and so I'm trying to figure out, okay, do I really understand first, second, and third force? And what happened was my husband and I had a meeting with an advisor, stranger, you know, didn't know him. During the meeting, my husband starts explaining me to them in a condescending way. I don't know if that would be a first force, and my second force is immediate anger and thinking, well, I can explain myself the best, you know. So I tell them the bottom line, why, you know, and it's more information than they need to know. It was a blunt sentence. And anyway, so we get into the parking lot in the truck, and he's quiet, and I'm like, all right, let me know what's going on. And he's yelling at me and angry and accusing, and I get angry and I start raising my voice. And then all of a sudden I think, I don't want to be that angry person. And it's like I, you know, went to observer mode and thought, that's a false eye. And after that, my heart rate calmed down. You know, I went back to calm mode and was able to communicate with kindness and objectivity. And so I'm wondering, you know, like in the truck, was the first force him getting angry at me, the second force me reacting to that anger, and the third force becoming aware of the false eye? I'm trying to think.
Well, Sabrina, it's a beautiful question, and I really appreciate your honest sharing. It's invulnerable. That's really powerful for all of us. This is something to just keep observing and to see for yourself. What is the first force in this? What is the second force? What is the third force? It's hard for anyone else to say what that is, but what you're describing sounds to me, the thing that I'm most intrigued by and what I'm just so celebrating and what I think is rare is the moment you caught yourself screaming or yelling or being angry, that moment of self-awareness is literally, you know, stepping up out of yourself. That's self-remembering. That's holy remembering. That something shifted in you inwardly that was able to calm yourself down and self-calm, which is not easy to do for most human beings. And biochemically and neurologically, that's almost impossible to do for some of us once that fight or flight thing gets going in the limbic system and in the brain. So congratulations, you know, on seeing that happen in real time. And just reporting on it now as it happened is also useful. You put it out here in front of the whole community, and you'll never be the same again because of your public sharing. You've just shared the event in a way that will change you forever because you've seen yourself in a deeper way going forward. So what the first force is, what the second force is in a marriage dynamic is hard to say precisely. And so it's not really very useful, but you can study it and see the dynamic of energy and how it moves and see where your first force was, where his first force was, and, you know, go from there. Second force can also be called passive, not just resisting. So it's very interesting to see how second force shows up in our lives. Anyway, I'm going on too much, but thank you so much for sharing, Sabrina. That's very vulnerable of you to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Welcome. Yep. We'll go to Jack and Jackie, and then we'll conclude with Douglas. If you all can keep it brief, I want our brother Robin to have his time tonight.
So can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I want to thank Todd Buchanan and then Lisa. I mean, when his sharing about the eye strong came up, and then Lisa's sharing, it just unfolded the three forces that I've observed worldly and internally. So my first force is I've got this great house. I want everything to be fine. Second force, ice storm. We lost several hundred-year-old oak trees. I mean, our backyard was decimated. And that second force from that world standpoint was, it sent me into deep sorrow. Internally, first force is I wish to apply the first conscious shock and incoming impressions. Second force was I was unable to do that. I just locked up. Third force in worldly and internally was that on Saturday, after hauling off a lot of oak, Saturday got warm. I grilled some lamb chops. The sun set, and I realized that evening, and I employed the work for the month of looking up into the sky. And with all the canopies of oak trees gone, most of them, I could see the full moon in the east, Mars above me, Jupiter to the left, Saturn beyond that in the ecliptic that I had never been able to see before. Because so there was a neutralizing force of things have changed, but it was a positive moment in worldly and in internally, because I realized third force internally was, thank you, God. Thank you, universe. And that's my report.
Thank you, Jack. And so every manifestation requires these three forces. And now the new manifestation is visibility of the stars in a way that wasn't there before. So
taking up my telescope tomorrow.
Thank you for sharing. It's so helpful. And Douglas, you're new to me, so welcome. Just to keep your sharing brief, and we'll move on to Robin. Thank you.
And thank you, Peter. I appreciate the opportunity to share. And thank you to whoever mentioned the Eucharist in the image today. That really resonated with me. I found that these classes in the email are very much a Eucharist for my soul. And one of the first things that I read from the Church of Conscious Harmony, which is related to the work, was, I think, On the Human Condition with Thomas Keating. And what really resonated with me was the idea of frustrated energies being out of alignment with God. And when we began to talk about the three forces, I related that, the need to work on my activity centers to bring things into alignment. And as I was practicing the work this week, it was interesting for me to notice how often I felt the need to respond at a lower vibrational level that generally would create more frustrated energies that I would become entangled in. And so I made it where I had this vision in my head that my first forces would be about bringing myself proactively in alignment. I found myself exercising my will in a way to restrain myself from responding or engaging in activities, and found myself more open to the work and being able to do the work and having a place for the work. To relate that to some of the readings, you know, as I read about the intelligence of the sun today, I had this immediate resistance to it. What does that mean? And I thought, well, let's keep reading, let's keep going. And it talked about the internalization of that. And it's so funny how often I have referred to the emails that come through from the Church of Conscious Harmony as rays of light and this calling with a star, a tree, and longing. Calling for the wisdom on the hill. You know, I felt that calling my whole life, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to be here.
Oh, thank you, Douglas. It's so heartening to hear, and welcome. And these are influences, and they are a kind of a third force for all of us to choose what we're going to digest. And it relates to our will, as you were saying, choosing. The will can choose something different when it's fed something different and has a different energy feeding it. So the will and second force and third force or and first force are really interesting to ponder. So welcome, Douglas. Look forward to getting to know you better on the journey. And let's just bow our hearts to everyone who's shared. What a rich time together. Really a beautiful example of what we're aiming for in the Journey School. This is the heart of it, personal work for the glory of God and our transformation. And now it's a joy to welcome Robin Bloor again, a dear friend in the work and a huge blessing to the global work community. Robin.
Thank you for that introduction. Let me share my screen. Can everybody see that? Good. So this presentation, it's about the octave of creation, which is what you're seeing down the right-hand side, or a representation of it. And the octave of transformation, which you're seeing on the other side of the screen. The octave of creation descends from the absolute. The act of creation is that of the absolute and his intention. And his, in effect, he allows the manifestation of the law of three and the law of seven into his universe. And that leads to what we are. And this rising octave here that ascends, this is our Jacob's ladder back to heaven. There's a path here through the presentation. I'll talk about the descending octave and the ascending octave, and about octaves within octaves. I'll say a few things about the ray of creation, and then I'll go into the octave of the work, the side octave and organic life, or our position in the great octave, and finally the full three octaves. And this is how Gurdjieff describes the law of seven. The line of the flow of forces constantly deflecting according to law and uniting again at its ends. Which is not entirely, let's say, clear. I've tried to represent this. We tend to think, oh, I didn't mean to do that. That shouldn't have. I don't know how to go back. I'll have to stop. Okay. We tend to represent octaves when we draw them on a piece of paper as though they were a straight line. They are never a straight line. When Gurdjieff referred to the notes in the octave, he referred to the notes as deflections. And that every note in one way or another has a particular characteristic as to how it deflects. And ultimately, within an octave, we have a marriage between do and do, and this is normally a doubling, let's say, of vibrations. But the easiest and best way to try to represent an octave is to think of it as a spiral from the lower to the higher, or from the higher to the lower. And if we're looking at it from above, then it would look like that. And that's just closer to the definition of what's being talked about. So there's two kinds of octaves. One is ascending and the other is descending. The descending octave is creative. And the I guess the model for that is the octave of the absolute and the absolute's creation of the universe. And if we look at this, I'm not I'm not going to go into the detail because we don't have a lot of time, but the descending octave with all of its notes actually matches the Lord's Prayer. It starts with Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, which is a sin absolute, thy will be done, which is the galaxies in earth as it is in heaven, give us this day our daily bread, which is the light of the sun, forgive us our trespasses, or forgive us our debts, but only in so far as we forgive those who trespass against us, which fills the interval. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. And this, the serpent bites its tail. It begins with the absolute and it ends with the absolute. We colour these notes differently, deliberately, so that one gets the impression that each note has a different character. In the act of creation, this interval, docet interval, is filled by intention. If the octave fails at this interval, the mi-far interval, there's going to be some evidence of what was intended, but it will be incomplete. Such failure is very common. People often explain it away by pretending that they did complete the octave when they didn't. A descending octave leads to multiplicity, the full remarkable nature of creation, even just on the planet Earth, is the outcome of many, many, many descending octaves from the absolute. So the ascending octave, ascending octaves are receptive in the sense that the thing being transformed is passive at every level. First difficulty encountered is at the mi-far interval, which cannot be passed without help from outside. Even more difficult to pass through the si-do interval, which I am not going to discuss in detail. A good example of an ascending octave is learning to do anything. How to do math, how to play tennis, how to play a tune on the piano. And such examples make it clear how difficult it is to complete an octave when it's ascending. So I'm giving as an example the idea of becoming a professional tennis player. So you start by playing the game as a child, you enjoy the game, become better, and then for it becomes something that you like to do. You reach the limit of personal ability, which is, this is hits the interval. You're really not going to go any further unless you have some kind of coach or some kind of help in order that you can play competitively, school perhaps, tennis club. And then proves good enough for professional tennis, that's would be the next step if it was going there. This is the point at which most people will fail if they get that far, because that area has three possible outcomes. One is failure, one is success, and one is staying still. Then becomes professional, then plays at the highest level, fulfills the personal potential, but you know, only one or two people ever become a champion, and that's just walking through an ascending octave. Now, if we look at the ray of creation, we have to think in terms of us individually having a ray of creation inside us. And then it would look like this. It's the note ray to me is the difference between these two is half the difference between me and soul, which is half the difference between sol and do. So we have one octave, two octave, three octaves. And the three foods, normal food, breath, and impressions, are what fills the octave. And that's what makes the human being, as well as there's some kind of something similar going on that makes the universe as a whole. Makes every living thing is exactly the marriage of these things within some octave or other. And it's the same for everything. So even planets, suns, and galaxies are structured like this. It's just not easy for us to understand how they feed, how they breathe, and how they take in impressions, because we are very small compared to them. So the key to all of this is as above, so below. Which actually is how we started the meeting today. So there's a tie-up. And the idea, really, God, man, microbe, all the same system. So they all have a ray of creation within. They all, in fact, have an eogram that defines their cosmos. Everything eats, breathes, and perceives. Not all life forms are exactly equal. Two-brained and one-brained beings, for example, have no possibility of evolution within their own lifetime. They don't have a spiritual possibility within the lifetime, but human beings do, because we are three-brained. Our Enneagram is slightly different. We have an intellectual ascension. We also have the possibility of using it to digest impressions. And if we do that, then it becomes possible for us in one way or another to evolve spiritually. So this is, I'm now going to go through, and this is possibly the most important slide, but I'm now going to go through the octave of the work. And this starts like this. We receive the ideas of the work by books, videos, verbally, join a group, whatever. And we need to think of an octave in the way that we're thinking of, that the notes repeat again and again and again. You do not stop receiving the ideas. I've been in the work since 1982, and I have been receiving the ideas of the work ever since then. The next note, we apply the ideas to ourselves, personally demonstrating their importance. If we can, we effectively prove the ideas out. And because if we do that honestly and sincerely, we'll discover things about ourselves, and our valuation of these ideas will rise. And then we encounter personal difficulties, lack of unity, mechanical behavior. The me-fire interval occurs at this point, and this is the most difficult part of the work. This is the area where most people stop. This is the point at which you need, let's say, or it'll be very, very useful to you if you have a genuine teacher who has gone past this point, who can in some way or other help you past it. It will really help if there are other people that you're working with, you know, because one hand washes the other in that case. The next step is the aim is formulated on personal knowledge acquired. We don't have the capability of having an aim. We might believe we do, but in actual fact, as we are, whatever we do, whatever our actions are, simply the resultant of all our desires. Let's say the democratic decision of all our desires. It's easy enough to formulate an aim in real life, because in one way or another you can use the shocks of real life to help you. But an aim in the work, there's only you that cares, and nothing external is going to help you. So this is a very lonely stage in the work, and it's a very difficult point. When we go past that point, we get to the area of purification. true aim, the execution of true aim will lead to purification. You can call this purgatory or the beginning of purgatory. And this is, again, the point. This is the harmonia. This is a point in the octave where success is uncertain. But if we proceed, this becomes a situation where we acquire objective conscience, and that begins to manifest, and that itself helps with purification. And if we go further, we will get to the point of impartiality, which incidentally is an emotion. Impartiality is absolutely an emotion. Some people kind of think of it intellectually. It isn't intellectual. And then finally, the connection to the higher intellect, it can occur here, but only if true purification of soul is achieved. So the thing to understand with this is that what tends to happen with everybody in the work is they go do, re, mi, re, do, re, mi, re, do. And they keep on, if you like, amplifying these three notes. And something very exceptional is required to pass the interval between mi and fa. This is where Gurdjieff said only super efforts count. And the way past this point is about emotion. You know, the intellect can take you so far in the work because it can help, if you like, it can help you articulate ideas and work through them. But the intellect can't take you past this point. The heart takes you past this point. This is, you know, there were things that happened to me, I would say, that were just experiences that I can't really talk about because it wouldn't be understood, really. But insofar as I ever spanned this bridge, it was a vision of Christ that took me across that bridge. So this just completes the picture. We have the ray of creation like that, but there is nothing here in terms of nature itself that's actually in the ray of creation. But it meets an interval at the note fa. And the sun sounds and the note do of a lateral octave, and this creates the conditions which allow the spanning of that interval. And it's filled by organic life. So do sounds there, a C sounds almost at the level of the planets, and this goes all around, all the way down to the do, lower do. This second octave is where organic life on Earth exists, and it fills this interval. So there's two things. We fill the interval here, but we also play a role in respect of the growth of the moon. This is all of nature I'm talking about, but man is an important part of this. So first of all, organic life is a transmitting station. This is from the planets through the earth, from the planets to the earth, using organic life as a neutralizing factor. Its substance of the planets mixes with the substance of the earth in a way that is mediated by organic life. The result is a substance, knowledge perhaps, that serves the earth. Organic life is thus a transmitting station for influences that would otherwise never reach the earth. As a carrier of the neutralizing forces is unchanged by that action of the planets. This is astrology. This is one way of explaining what the idea of fate actually is, because this is the influence of the planets on organic life on Earth, and organic life on Earth is subject to this. And if we get to the point La, that's a realized man, then he has a fate. The I can tell this story because it's an important way to look at things, but Kurt Vonnegut wrote in one of his science fiction books a very short story about two particles of yeast that were discussing the meaning of life, and they talked to each other for a long time, and they examined all the yeast philosophy that they'd ever heard of, and they examined one by one the various yeast religions and the findings of all the yeast scientists, and even, you know, the various creative expressions of all the yeast artists, and they talked for a long, long time, but they never got round to realizing the true meaning of their life was that we were making champagne. And this is the situation of life on Earth. It's making champagne, it's serving something else. So the first thing is that the planets affect us by magnetic influence. There's no way to shield that except by using shields made from magnetically permeable materials like iron. So you can go into Faraday cage and shield magnetic influence, but as you are, you can't shield it. The Earth does not shield organic life from magnetic influence of planets. And then by electromagnetic radiation along all wavelengths, all planets emit EMR, and they reflect EMR originating with the sun as well. So the Earth's atmosphere shields organic life from almost all shortwave radiation, because that would kill us, but all the other radiation gets through and affects us. This is the idea of food for the moon. And this is a different, this is organic life is active, the moon is passive, and Earth is neutralizing. It's the death of organic life which feeds the moon mostly. So some substances of organic life mixed with some substances of the moon in neutralizing forces the Earth. Result is that the moon is fed. Humanity can be active or passive in this. You can either, through spiritual activity, remembering yourself, you will actually feed the moon voluntarily. But if you don't, then you will feed the moon on your death, and you may feed the moon simply by the expression of negative emotion. So most likely the moon is feeding on the hydrogens of the immune system and the hydrogens of thought, or if you like, mechanicality. Gurdjieff names the substances Avrostatis and Halcyonis. Evidence suggests that at death a splitting apart occurs between essence and personality, possibly also the body of reason, but the personality goes to the moon. The Earth, by its electric and magnetic nature, transports the food to the moon. It's done with the magnetosphere. First of all, the stratosphere, stratospheric electricity, and then into the magnetosphere, and the moon passes into the Earth's magnetosphere for 5 days every month. So this is the final picture, and I'm just completing it. And I would advise you, if this interests you, to take a copy of it and study it. Because we just went through the first lateral octave of the that's created in the sun and goes all the way to the negative dome. But there's another octave, which is created here, Sol. And this is the, if you like, it's the vibration of Sataniel, or sometimes called Satan. And this is the octave of Satan. And it's these three octaves that complete the ray of creation. And if you like, you could draw that as a descending Enneagram. Although you might have a bit of difficulty. So this is, Sathaniel is the lord of this world, the fallen angel who represented the representative of the moon on earth, the cloven hoofs. He's symbolized by the goat, which is a vertebrate, and so on. But because man falls below his normal level, he also, there's this interaction between man and Satan, which man has to resist, or hopefully man is able to resist. In old Christian tradition, he was referred to as the thwarter of man. That's orthodox. And just as prophets and teachers descend to interact with man, Samuel rises above his realm to provide an obstacle to man's evolution. All of this, there are a whole series of plasma beings which I won't talk about that fill this octave. So, I've talked about the descending octave, octaves within octaves, the ray of creation, revisited, the octave of the work, side octave and organic life, and the picture of all three octaves. So if we have time, I can take some questions. Lisa Morgan.
Yes, hi, Robin. I have a question about, you had mentioned impartiality is an emotion. And yeah. It struck me that the reading about Janine Desalzman at the beginning maybe was a disposition of impartiality. But I would like for you to elaborate a little bit about what you mean about that.
Yeah, this is best experienced is the thing to say. But in certain circumstances, you have to be remembering yourself already. And you have to receive a shock from the outside world, which involves a strong emotion. It will normally be a negative emotion. It doesn't have to be. The impartiality comes from not identifying with the force that's running through you in that. It's often the case that in those situations you just feel the emotional pain, or alternatively you feel the emotional joy. This sometimes happens to people for a brief second when a close relative dies, but they'll normally self-calm and stop it. So the impartiality is actually an impartiality to anything positive or negative in the emotional experience that goes with it. You can have, if you like, you can talk about being intellectually impartial to the situation, but that's just talk. You actually have to be there and be impartial. Does that make sense to you?
Thank you.
So, Rachel.
Hey, Robin. I was wondering, you were talking about how most people don't move past above, don't ascend further above the first, those three notes. And I was wondering what, just in your studying, what do you think the reason is for that?
It's emotional. It's always when all of Ouspensky's people, the ones that did, went to Gurdjieff, he declared them all. He may have been generalizing, but he referred to them all as enlightened idiots. That they knew exactly what to do, but they couldn't do it. And the reason that he couldn't do it was because of a fault. Well, he describes it as because of a fault in grammar. But you know, because they hadn't paid the debts of the past.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain necessity to pay the debts of the past to go through that interval.
Mm-hmm. an unloading, like emotional unloading?
That is, we talk in the work about keeping accounts. This is a liquidation of all accounts. That's not the only thing it's a liquidation of, but it's a liquidation of all accounts. It's it involves, in one way or another, seeing yourself for what you are. So there are various events that you were involved in that your personality, in one way or another, made excuses and even covered up and whatever. You have to see yourself as you are. And the problem for the enlightened idiot, it's a severe problem. The problem for the enlightened idiot is if you don't go up, you're going to go down. Just, nothing stays in the same place. So there's a certain point. When Maurice Nicole went to Gurdjieff in the first instance, Gurdjieff told him to stop reading because he knew enough.
Thank you.
Jim?
Yeah, Robin, we have one short moment for one person.
Okay, well, it'll have to be Jim.
Yes, I'm wondering, Robin, if an individual can be on an ascending octave and a descending octave on multiple octaves simultaneously.
Well, in any specific octave, you're in a particular position. You could be in multiple octaves. People are. You have an octave of your profession. You have an octave of your family life. You have all of those different octaves. But in any given octave, you're in one position with certain events occurring. They will all happen according to the law of three, and you will either be ascending or descending. And people go up and down. Jacob's ladder isn't just you climb up. You know, it's more like a game of snakes and ladders where you climb up the ladders and you go down the snakes.
Thank you.
That's not a very positive point to finish on, but I guess that's where we are. Mary Ann. Okay.
Yes, thank you so much, Robin, for all of your gifts. And just a reminder to everyone, because we were short on this particular time of the evening, and Jack and Jackie, if you have a point, I would encourage you to begin our session next time with that. But in the archives, there will be a recording of our time along with Robin's slides, and you can listen and view the slides at the same time, take it in again, and allow it to do its work. So thank you for everyone for a very enriching evening. And Robin, it's always a great privilege to have you here with us. So let us close again by our night prayers and praying aloud and affirming wherever we are the prayer of God's infinite love. That God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen.